The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and we have a wonderful treat coming up. It's a conversation with Paul Sand, who is 91 years young.
Yeah.
And is the author and leading actor in a current play in L.A. called The Pilot Who Crashed the Party.
And we sort of just started our conversation, which is why we're doing the intro after the fact, because he started telling stories and we were not going to stop him. So we hope you enjoy the episode.
Did you conceive of this show from scratch?
Oh, yes. I absolutely, yes. I noticed at an early age that people assumed, because you look away or you're dressed away a certain way or your hair is this or that, that you are this kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And lay it on you, they treat you like you're this other person. So the impression they get is the first 2 minutes, and then they'll treat you like someone they've made up for 20 years, you know? And that it happens a lot in romances and marriages, you know? Like after 4 years, someone will say, what happened to you? You're not who I thought you were. You've changed. And they haven't changed at all. They're just not the person that they were assumed to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that is fascinating to me and dramatic to me. So I wrote this play kind of about that subject. I mean, no, about that subject, really. And but anyway, and I'm considering this kind of a work in progress, but that's okay.
Well, again, I mean, the theater is alive, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. It can shape and it can move, and it doesn't have to be perfect.
There's an invisible shifting of the mood on the stage. And I don't know whether it comes from the vibes of the particular audience. Like I notice Saturday nights, they're bam, right there. And they're like, want to play, and they get everything. And Sunday matinees, you feel like, well, they're waiting to go home and eat, or they're watching TV, and so they don't react. And then the actors get depressed because nobody's laughing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the strangest thing.
It is a two-way communication, isn't it, with the audience?
Oh, yeah.
Great part. Yeah, and when the energy is there, when even one or two people in the audience can really trigger the rest of the people,
mm-hmm.
and they'll get going or something. So I come out now before the show and sort of, I guess, do like a warm-up. Mm-hmm. Like, television to like talk to him. Hi, and my name is Paul, and I wrote this thing, and somebody told me I was a surrealist last week. And so I talk about that. I went to see some Chekhov play in New York, and there was an actress, and I hate myself for can't think of her name, but there was Laurence Olivier on the stage, and it was Michael Redgrave. We were on the stage, and they were having a Chekhov discussion, and she was on a chaise longue reading a book in the background. I could not take my eyes off of her. And I knew that she was listening to these guys and was trying to concentrate on the book and reading the same paragraph over and over again, because she was really being pulled that way. I got out of my seat on the orchestra level of the theater and crept down the aisle so I could get as close as I could to see her. So in other words, I sort of came in for a close-up.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to... Kim Stanley was the actress.
Oh, well.
Yes, yes. Unbelievable. She did nothing big. I don't even think she turned a page. And brilliant, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, but there's some people who are just magnetic that way. There's some people you can't take your eyes off. And she was apparently one.
Mm. Yeah, I think focus is everything. Being now this director, I can help an actor by telling them to focus on what they're doing. Really focus. And that really helps them get into the character more and more, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, yeah, so.
Now, you are that in this movie called Lauren and Rose, which I saw not long ago. And it's essentially a two-character piece and a vehicle for Jacqueline Bisset, and a very nice vehicle for her. And she plays an older actress who's being courted by a young screenwriter, young would-be a film director. And they are the movie. Their conversation and the way it evolves over four or five scenes. But you are the waiter in their restaurant. And I don't know if stealing the scene is quite the right word. But every time you're on camera, Paul, I'm looking at you.
Isn't that interesting? She came to the show yesterday, my play, and we've become sort of friends. Mm-hmm. Or I'll go to a dinner at her house, and we'll hug each other and happy to see each other. But we don't like go to the movies together or eat a Chinese dinner together. But she's always there. She came to the play and didn't get it at all.
Really?
Is he a womanizer? Is that it? And no, the guy's a spy, you know. Anyway, so we see things differently, but they're doing the movie, a little tour of the festival circuit.
Yes.
And says that people really like this modest little role I have. So, but anyway, well, thank you. All I do is focus and try to remember my lines.
Mm-hmm. You don't blend into the scenery, let's put it that way.
That's good, but I don't try to steal it. I just try to listen to what they're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how did Pablo Sanchez, I was going to say, how did a nice Jewish boy wind up in Paris, France with Marcel Marceau, but you're only half a nice Jewish boy.
That's true. I'm half Mexican and half Russian Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I'm used to it. So I know it might make you go, oh, how unusual. Well, which maybe it is, but I'm used to it. So to me, it's nothing, you know. But I did most of my reading as a teenager, and I read a lot of French writers and I had a wonderful girlfriend named Vicky White, who I just loved, and she and I got very kind of French, and my hair got long and dark and turtlenecks, and I had a jalopy to drive around, and she had a giant dog, and so I became kind of, I guess, Francophile. Is that what they're called?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Interested in the arts in France. So I got out of high school and went to Paris and knocked on the door of Marcel Marceau and auditioned and got into his company. So I don't know. Well, that's interesting because, okay, so you're saying a nice Jewish guy and Mexican, you might think that sort of. So wait a minute. So then maybe So maybe you're projecting something onto me.
Possibly, but I didn't mean to.
No, wait, back up. It's not a bad thing. It's a human thing. You remember Gordon Davidson?
Yes.
Oh, go ahead. He read the very first draft of this script. And he said, you could do this play all over the world because everybody does this to each other. And this is an example, a theatrical, extreme example of, I don't mean to be psychologique, but a projecting part of your dark self onto another person. Mm-hmm. And so that's what this play is about. All the dinner guests all project certain secret parts of themselves, and all of them say, you and I are very much alike, you know. And that's sort of beginning of every conversation and of every bit of trouble that can come out of this, because and I think it's the same in politics. You know, we assume that all the Chinese are bad, and all the Russians are bad, or you know what I'm saying. I don't have to yeah. But yes, I did think it up and think about it, but I was already busy acting on television and some movies, and only during the pandemic did I sort of have nothing to do, and thought I'd look at it and go, oh, I got this idea. I'm going to make him a da, 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 da. I won't tell you. I don't want to give it away.
Sure.
But I ended the play, and so I like it, but it's not very subtle. No.
It's called The Pilot Who Crashed the Party. And it's the Broadwater main stage here in L.A. on Lillian Way. And how long will you be playing it?
Until May 7.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And it's a wonderful stage. They have a terrific, very long Broadwater. They have a very long broad stage. And they have a stairway, which I take advantage of and did paint it white, even though they didn't want me to. And anyway,
But it's funny what you're saying, though, about certain things are universal, right? And again, this is something that I think theater, film too, you often say, Daddy, that we'll watch a movie and the more specific it is to something, the more universal it becomes. So you make a movie specifically about your family and a problem that you had, and people go, oh my God, I relate to that in such a significant way. My husband always says, you can always tell when a man's in, doesn't matter what the language is, you can always tell when a man's in trouble. It doesn't matter what they're speaking. If that wife or girlfriend is yelling at them, you know exactly what happened. And it's just the truth.
I think so. Well, the truth, I even have a line there in the play when the pilot says to the hostess after she tells him a long story about this love affair with a Brazilian cowboy.
As one does.
And then he said, is that a true story? or are you just trying to keep me awake? Because that's the story. They have to keep the pilot awake because they don't know if he has a concussion or not.
Okay.
We can't just sleep in the other room. So right. They all turns talking to him. There's like a schedule for each character has to come to talk to him. And when they talk to him, they always feel they're very much alike. That always starts it. And so he said to her, is that the truth? And she said, yes. The truth is much, always more interesting than lies. And that's kind of true. Lies, you know, it's boring. You know, the truth has always got some wonderful other thing happening.
Yeah.
Well, my dad had Parkinson's, and he didn't get the wonderful drugs that you get these years. That's so great.
It's very different now. And see, because he lives with two neurotic old Jewish ladies, me and my mother, we got him diagnosed fairly quickly and got him on medication fairly quickly.
Wonderful. Because I would never guess by having a conversation with you that you have a sore foot.
Yeah, I'll tell. So he does. He has tremors like many people with Parkinson's do. And our favorite thing is that he consistently holds things in the bad hand. So we constantly say, this hand doesn't shake. Hold everything in this hand. And yet he always holds it in the shaky hand. So the running joke now is, you know, obviously the film Blazing Saddles.
Yes.
You know, sure. And he's talking to
Gene Wilder.
Gene Wilder, and he says, you see this? Steady as a rock. But this is the one I shoot with. And that's become the joke in our house with my dad. But I went to you up to different things, mm-hmm. and understanding people in a different way.
Yeah. I'm anxious, as you can tell, to tell you a story.
Please.
I went to have a wisdom tooth taken out, and I had to go to a certain dentist. You know, your dentist always sends you someplace.
Somewhere else.
A specialist. And so I went in, and there was this nice guy, dentist, I'd say in his 60s or something, or no, probably older. And he comes at me. I'm in the chair, and he's got a hypodermic in his hand, and it's shaking.
Oh, God.
And he said, open your mouth. And it's shaking. And I opened my mouth, and then he just went highly focused and perfect. No pain at all. You know what I mean? But the assumption was this is going to be a wreck.
Yeah.
And he knew better. He knew who he really was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he went in and boom.
Like nothing. Yeah.
Amazing. Some kind of mysterious lesson. I can't tell you.
I want to ask you about Marcel Marceau, just because obviously the people who learn from him and work with him have the best stories. You know, those of us who just grew up watching him and learning about him, it's different, but you spent significant amounts of time with him.
Yeah.
What was it like?
I'll tell you something funny. I could always do that. As a child, I was sort of miming around the house, but I never even knew what a mime was. But it seemed to me that talking was a little overrated, and that I remember going to the movies and a close up of somebody thinking and touching their lip maybe was so compelling. So, and then the other part of that same story is that my parents came from a generation that found lying to each other was normal. Everybody, I was a little kid, and I'm sitting and I'm watching people lying and carrying on and having scrambled eggs, and I didn't want that. And So when I got out of high school, I had seen Children of Paradise and Jean-Louis Barrault.
Yep.
And I knew he didn't teach, but I met Barrault in Paris, and that's a whole other story. But I just didn't want to. I didn't want to talk, and I had to learn a new language and start all over, and not get in the habit of this casual, harmless lying. Lying to me is such a waste of time, you know. Unless maybe you're a spy and you have to so you don't get killed. And that, I understand that. But, yeah, so how was it? He was, he came galloping in to rehearsal one day in this wonderful move, like he's on a horse, you know. And I was knocked out and I say, "Oh my God, how do you do that?" He go, "You would like to know, wouldn't you?" Well, yeah, I'm working in your company.
That's why I'm here, yeah.
A teacher, so yeah. So, but it was like, no, that's so fast kind of thing, you know. But he was, I liked him. He and his wife at the time, her name is Huguette, kind of took me in and fed me. I weighed about 5 pounds, I guess. I was 6 feet, so they would feed me and make sure that I was okay. And so they were very friendly and very, yeah, nice. Yeah. So, but you want to know, he would do novels, like called Mimo Drama. He would do whole novels in pantomime. And he had a company of 7 people, and we all played different characters in the novel, but all in mime, you know. And it was a fascinating experience, and I've never seen it anywhere since. But he was known in European countries for these mimo dramas. So how was he? Very decent man, friendly, generous, up to a point. I understand it, wanting to protect your gifts, but then wanting to give at the same time. I get it. I liked every second with them very much. Met some interesting people, very interesting people. And then one day I just sort of felt it's time to go home. It's either a decision I had to make. Do I stay in Paris, become an American in Paris, and be an actor? And how do you do that? And it seemed like I wanted to go home and make a career and a life in Los Angeles and New York. And I did. But he came to visit once, and my mom made him a chicken dinner, and he ate an entire piece of chicken with a knife and fork and cut around the bones like a surgeon. Like there was not one bit of meat left on any bone. It looked like a creature in the desert. The skeleton of in the desert of a bird that when he finished it, and don't know how he did that, but he did it, and he was nice to my parents, and he was like a cousin to me, you know, like a friendly cousin. Yeah, does that help at all?
Oh yeah,
of course.
I find it interesting that you studied and were attracted to mime. Pantomime, but then you wound up in Chicago, you know, helping to invent and develop what we now know as improv comedy, which is all talk, not all talk, but it's largely verbal.
Yeah. Yeah, and may I tell you that? I won't take up too much of your time, but
we're here for you and your stories, Paul. So you okay. Go right on ahead.
And well, growing up, I studied with Viola Spolin, mm-hmm. the mother of improvisation in this century. And then she had a son named Paul Sills, and I was a student of hers. I guess I was about 10 or 11 or something years old. And her son came to Los Angeles with his friend, Elaine May. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to watch the kids play. And so life goes on, years go on. And then I get a letter from him saying, "Do you still do what you did as a kid?" So I said, I don't know. And he said, "Well, I'm starting this company, Second City, and we opened, and it works. And come and work with us." So I got off the plane cold one night, found Second City, looked in the window and could see the stage, and all these wonderful actors were improvising, and the audience was laughing and carrying on. And I knew they were all from the University of Chicago and really smart and knew everything, read the paper every day, very up to it. And I was the opposite of that. I had practically no education, I mean, other than high school and life, you know. But so I wouldn't talk during the improvisations. They would, at the end of every show, we would take suggestions, and I would always take like an object. If someone said baseball, you know, or, and then one yelled out once, "Phonograph record." So I took that one, and I got an idea to make a record, to pretend I'm listening to a record called How to Win a Friend. Because I picked that because earlier that afternoon, I saw a man on the bus reading How to Win Friends and Influence People. Okay. So one of the actors named Eugene Trubnik, complicated and nice man, said, "I'll be the voice on the record." And I said, "Okay." So we go downstairs, blam, like, and I have not been talking. I was there for a year, and I was always like the guy underwater or something. Someone not talking, and, you know, I never did a pantomime, but just avoided talking. But this guy reading How to Win Friends and Influence People on the bus really moved me. I thought, oh my God, he really wants a friend. And he's learning out of a paperback book. So I assumed what he's like and got on stage, and the announcer said, "And now for your suggestion, phonograph record, here is Paul doing How to Win a Friend." And so being a mime, I could like take the record out, put it on the thing, turn on the click on the volume. And when I did that, Eugene went like, and, you know, and put the record down, and he'd make the record noises like that. And then he said, "Hi," which intimidated me because I've never talked on this stage before. And I don't know if I knew how to talk. And I said, "Hi." He said, "So you want to win a friend?" And I go, "Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah, like that." And he said, "Well, we can take care of that." And I was like, okay. So what he would say something like, "Now you have to be able to tell jokes." And I said, "No, I can't. I can't remember any jokes." And he would interrupt me because he's on a record. and I'm not, he interrupt me by going, uh-huh. And I go, oh, wait a minute. Okay, I got this joke. I got this joke. And I start a joke. And then he'd laugh as if I had finished the joke. You know what I mean? So it was kind of, you understand what I'm saying?
Everything was off. Yeah.
It was off. Right. And then at the very end, he said, what? You've made your first friend. And I really like that. And he said, come here, come closer. And I go, what? I'm here. What? And he goes, how does it feel to have made your first friend? You like the record got stuck, you know what I mean? So point of my telling you this story is, in pantomime, in mime, or improvisation, if the subject interests you, you can really talk and feel it and talk about it. And so I learned that. And so from then on, I would only take a suggestion if I felt it, if I liked it, if I was moved, funny or serious, whatever it was. And so I would give that sort of advice to anybody interested in pantomime, is just do what interests you. I mean, not pantomime, but yeah, improvisation. So I didn't shut up then forever after. You know, by this our conversation. But was that clear?
Yeah, you figured out what you liked and what worked for you, and you ran with it.
Now, see, I would never think of putting it in those words, and that's perfect. Yeah.
Well, it's what I'm here for.
It's great. I appreciate that. That's good. Yeah. I had to like go on all around it, but in my own way, express what you can like. Just, what, are you a Virgo or what?
Gemini.
Oh, okay. I'm Gemini rising.
I'm not good at all of that. I have friends who are very good. I am not.
I'm really good at it, but I have suspicions there's something there that has been taken over by people who want power in a relationship or something. Well, what's your sign and this and that? But I suspect there's something there because the moon will affect the tides, et cetera, et cetera. But don't get me wrong. Yeah, don't assume that I'm a astrological knowledgeable person because I'm not. Yeah.
When you started doing television, filmed television, and movies, did the lack of an audience bother you? Mm-hmm. Having had that immediate response that you got at Second City, which I imagine was like a shot of adrenaline. Suddenly, you know, you're on a sound stage and don't have that.
No, it's so, I don't know how one adapts, but, well, if you're working with an actor, like, you know, fortunately, I got to work with some really accomplished people.
Sure.
Right away. I married Tyler Moore and all these people that are used to all that. And they look you right in the eye and they talk to you and you've got some lines to say. So you're merely having a conversation. And so it's just the give and take between the, so that's really an awful lot of fun. No, you really don't play for the joke. That's a mistake. It kind of taught these days in improvisation to tell a joke, get as many jokes in as you can, which Paul Sills did not allow. If something funny came up and out of you, that's what he really encouraged, you know. Well, usually it was something that the audience could identify personally from themselves.
Is it true that the director Peter Yates hired you for the Hot Rock after seeing your acceptance speech at the Tonys?
Yes. Yeah. I got this call to come in and meet Peter Yates and do an audition. And I go in and he says, and I was on Broadway at the time doing a play and Story Theater. And he said, I really am sorry. I have not seen your show yet, but I loved your acceptance speech. And he said, could you want to read this scene? And so, and I did. And then he said, can you do that again? Because I think a tear came out of my eye, because the audition piece was about a guy lying to his girlfriend to get sympathy so he could get laid. So it was sort of a terrible person. But and I did it. And I remember a tear came down talking about my dead ex-girlfriend. And so we said, can you do that again? And it was nothing to it, because you just can, you know, I mean, we're all capable of anything. So, yeah, I did it. And especially if the writing or the story or the actor really gives you something, then you can get involved. So I did it again and then got hired and got to do that. And after a big scene where they're going to throw me down an elevator shaft, and my father, who's my father in that?
Zero Mostel.
Yeah, my Zero Mostel. We were trying to fool him in the play, in the movie, that they were really going to throw me down. Anyway, we did this big dramatic scene, and the monster guy came up and lifted me up in the air, and I'm going, no! And then we did the whole scene and threw me down the elevator shaft, but I only went like this far. And then Peter Yates said, when they, after he said cut, he said, who said theater is dead? Because we did absolute theater, soundstage, and it was really exciting. So you get your feedback, you know, from the director. And but I did another movie with Barbra Streisand, and the director said, "That's it. That's the scene. That's cut." Okay, and I go, and Barbra Streisand said, "You want to do another one, Paul? Another take?" And I went, "Yeah." And she said, "Let him do another take." So I did another take, and I felt right. And she said, "How do you feel about that one?" And I go, "Yeah, I like that one." She said, "Okay, that's a take. Print that one." So they're around you, you know. Some can be, if you're lucky, some lovely, creative people around you.
Yeah. That's a kindness, isn't it? It's a kindness to do that.
It's an understanding, empathetic, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Understanding. They can see that, you know, Paul was not comfortable with that take, even though the director was. Mm-hmm. I'm Barbra Streisand, and I have the power. And she'd be like, did it. So,
if she says, then it's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really liked her. That, you know, she's all, her only problem was that she was a perfectionist.
Yeah. Right.
Perfectionist. And I admire that. I try to go for it. The least you can do is go for it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I really liked her and admired her. And we'd sit and have lunch watching other people. And she would make comments about two guys playing ping pong. And she goes, look at them. No wonder men and women don't get along. Look at those guys.
I mean, well, observing people is really what any actor does, right?
You just do it.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, I should. It's in your nature. You know, I remember as a kid just hearing my parents and their breakfast guests lie to each other. So, and I, children know, you know, so you just know. Yeah.
Did your parents live long enough to see your success?
Yeah, success. Yeah. Well, they, I'll tell you a little short story. Yeah. They came into New York to see opening night of Story Theater. Mm-hmm. And so I said, let's not meet until after the show. Then there's a party, and then come to the party and we'll meet. So it was the custom in the theater, at least in Paul Sills Theater, the opening night, or the day of opening night, you sort of all lie on the floor after you have a good night's sleep, and you just say your lines from the beginning of the play to the end of the play, everyone lying on their backs and doing the whole play. And then you can go and do anything you want and then be here at 7 o'clock or something. So there's a certain painting I love of Matisse, and I went to the Museum of Modern Art and sat and or looked at this painting because I thought it was perfect. And I thought it wouldn't hurt a guy to look at perfection for a while. It might rub off on you, you know. And then it was sort of getting late, and I start walking back up Fifth Avenue, and there's a lot of people. And I bump into this lady, and I say, oh, excuse me. And it's my mother from Santa Monica. What is that about? And I said, Mom. And she said, Paul. And I said, well, let's meet later. I don't want to get distracted, you know. So, but that was so freaky.
Yeah, I think so.
4 million people on Fifth Avenue at 4 o'clock to bump into your mother, who just got off a plane from Santa Monica, is a big deal, you know. So that was, so yes, so they came to the show and they felt good and they liked it.
I'm so glad. Anybody who's interested in improvisation knows the name Viola Spolin and her famous theater games. But I'm not sure I understand what they consisted of. Could you explain to me what a theater game would consist of?
I'll tell you the absolute truth. Her company for children was called the Young Actors Company. Mm-hmm. She was experimenting with these games that she had learned by working with a woman in Chicago with underprivileged children, etc., on these games. And she saw what these games did to these children, made them so open and so social and so this or so that, and that she invented these games. So I was with a group of young actors who were raised on these theater games. Now, that's just became my unconscious technique. So I'll do a scene on television and I go, oh, there's a game called What's Beyond. And I'll do the scene like that. So the scene in the television show was, I'm delivering a package and I have a taxi waiting and I'm in a hurry. So that the taxi with its ticking meter was my What's Beyond.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
About, I'm here till I give the package and I have to, anyway, I never mentioned it, but that was what the scene was about. And so I didn't use that. And my co-actor in the scene said, how did you do that? What were you doing? And I said, well, it's called What's Beyond. In other words, the games are automatically my technique. You know, And but if you're like on Broadway and you've done the scene every night for a year, and then you can start thinking during a very dramatic scene of what you're going to have for dinner with Linda tonight. but everyone believes it outside. So then that's when I use method acting. I'm in a very tense and dangerous situation on the stage, and I have these wonderful nephews that I adore, and little kids. And so I would put them in a dangerous situation, which triggered an emotion in me, and to play the rest of the scene like with that emotion. And so I use a bit of that. It's sort of like cooking, maybe, you know, an ingredient here and an ingredient there. And don't feel like talking right away. Maybe wait. Even when I'm directing now, I want pauses a lot. Not uncomfortable, self-conscious pauses, but not everybody talks blah, blah, blah constantly, unless we're being interviewed by Leonard Maltin.
Right.
Then I'll talk.
Well, Paul, you're an example of someone who is chronologically a senior citizen, but mentally and psychically a youthful person,
a whippersnapper.
Because you're obviously you're still curious, you're still engaged, you're still creative. And that's inspiring.
Well, I'm glad that it's inspiring, because that means we're all getting something out of it. And I'm not doing it to be inspiring. I'll just talk and something works for somebody else. That's good, you know. But and some people say, God, at your age, it's really good for you to be doing this. And I have to tell them, I'm not doing it because it's good for me.
Yeah.
I'm doing it because I can't help it.
Yeah.
I've got to find the money and put on the show and work with these heavenly actors and watch their fears and help them through their fears. And it's there. So it's not to stay young or anything.
Yeah.
No. That's not what drives you, but it's what we observe in you.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you. I think I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
And we're encouraging all of our Los Angeles listeners,
our West Coast based,
to look up the pilot who crashed the party at the Broadwater main stage. And you can look it up online at
onstage411.com. So the website is onstage411.com/pilot.
An opportunity for a person in my position is very grateful for your interview.
We're happy to do it and wish you Godspeed. Well, that was fun.
You know, I always say this, but there's only a few folks left who can give you firsthand accounts of Marcel Marceau or Viola. You know, it's very, very special. And I'm grateful that he made time for us. But as you said, it's also really lovely to see that the passion is there and there's no need to stop. Why would you? You know, it's what brings you joy and it fuels you as a person.
Yep.
You know, just wonderful. So if you have a chance, folks, go and see the show.
And by the way, Alice and I watched The Hot Rock recently, not having seen it in years. I think it was made in 1972. It's a terrific movie. Robert Redford and a stellar cast, including Paul. And it's worth, if you haven't seen it, see it. And if you haven't seen it in a long time,
Revisit. Thank you guys, as always, for your time. You can find us at Jesse Malton, at Leonard Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. You are also on Facebook. We have a YouTube channel, Maltin on Movies, and there's leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
And Patreon, patreon.com patreon.com/MaltonOnMovies, where you can help support what we do. And we thank you for that.
That's it. That's the whole thing.
That's it. We just finished.
We'll see you next time.
See you next time. So long for now. Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.